This is Geology Bites with Oliver Strumpel. Gemstones have value not only because they're beautiful, but also because they're rare. What exactly is a gemstone, and what makes them so rare? Lee Groach is a professor in the Department of Earth, Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of British Columbia. He studies the mineralogy of gemstones, and also works in the field, having conducted surveys of parts of northern Canada looking for emeralds. Lee Groat, welcome to Geology Bites.
Thank you.
Is there a geological definition of a gemstone?
Not really. The definition is more set by the market. A gem is what people will pay for its beauty and adornment value.
Gems are crystalline materials that contain several different elements. It's not really a gem, but a simple example is quartz, which has two elements, silicon and oxygen. Are there some gems that are just a single pure element?
Well, the best example is diamond, which is just carbon. But most, almost all, gemstones are combinations of elements. For example, gem corundum is sapphire, ruby is aluminum and oxygen, and a small amount of a chromophore, or a transition element that gives it color.
Just to explain, corundum is the crystalline form of aluminium oxide, and it occurs in two gem varieties, ruby and sapphire. So in crystalline rocks, these element combinations occur as minerals. Are gemstone crystals made of a single mineral only?
Most are single minerals. You can have an ornamental stone, of course, that is a combination of minerals, but most of what we think of as gemstones are single species.
So you mentioned a chromophore just a moment ago. That, I presume, is a trace amount of some material, some element, that makes a profound effect on the color of the mineral. How does that work?
They work by changing the absorption spectrum of the mineral. And this is because chromophores can have an effect on what we call the crystal field of the mineral. And for example, a small amount of chromium in corundum can change the color to red. But that small amount of chromium in a beryl will give you a green color, give you emerald. So in both cases, the chromophore is chromium, but the crystal structures are very different. And so the type and distances of atoms around that chromophore lead to different absorption spectra. And that's why we get the different colors.
Do these chromophores actually replace some of the major elements in the crystal lattice?
In most cases, for example, in corundum, chromium replaces aluminum. But there are cases where you actually have a chromophore in a site in the crystal structure that's usually empty. For example, we fairly recently determined that the color of aquamarine, which is blue gem beryl, is due to interaction between iron replacing aluminum in the crystal structure and another iron in a site that's usually empty. And those two iron atoms trade back and forth an electron, and that leads to absorption, an absorption curve that lets blue through and absorbs other colors, and that's how we get aquamarine. But that took a long time to sort out because the amounts of iron are vanishingly small and very difficult to measure.
So are we talking parts per million? Just how trace are these chromophores?
Well, they're very trace, usually more than one part per million. In the case of, say, emerald, you might be looking at about 0.1 weight percent chromium oxide. Yeah, it can be very, very small amounts.
As I mentioned in the introduction, gems are rare. What makes them so rare?
They're rare because the conditions to form them are unusual. And the example I usually use is emerald. Now, emerald is a mineral beryl, so you need beryllium. And the chromophore to give the green color is usually chromium. And beryllium and chromium travel in very different geochemical circles. Beryllium is usually associated with granitic intrusions, and chromium is an oceanic element associated with basalts and rocks like that. And so usually they don't come into contact. So we need unusual circumstances. Like in Yukon Territory in Canada, we have chromium-rich rocks, which are part of terrains that were ancient island arcs that were scraped onto the North American continent. And then these were later intruded by granites. And there are a couple places where we have emerald occurrences because the beryllium and chromium could come into contact.
When we were talking earlier, you also mentioned an example where we had these emeralds, but we couldn't really find any granite nearby.
Yeah, that's a case in Colombia. And the world's best emeralds come from Colombia, and there's over 200 occurrences and about a dozen producing mines. But there are no intrusions, and studies have suggested that all the components needed to make the emeralds come from the host black shale. So the chromium, the beryllium, the oxygen, the silicon, the aluminum, that these all came from the black shale, and they were scavenged by fluids, by brines.
Just to explain, shales are fine-grained sedimentary rocks, and black shales are shales that are rich in carbon.
Yeah, so it's a very unique and different type of genesis. And for a long time, it was thought that Colombian-type emeralds were only found in Colombia, that these conditions didn't happen anywhere else. But in 2010, there was an occurrence in the Northwest Territories in Canada, which appears to be similar. So that's one thing we're doing, is we're keeping our eyes open and developing ways to explore for Colombian-type emeralds in places where we expect they would be, like northern Canada.
Apart from bringing together elements that don't normally cross paths, are there other kinds of rare geological conditions that give rise to gems?
Yeah, definitely. We've been working on red beryl occurrences in Utah. And this is where the manganese, which is the chromophore in this case, is in lava flows, and that these beryls are forming in basically gas bubbles in a relatively recent lava flow. So that's one example. Others, for example, opal, they form where there's lots of silicon, and the best precious type opal, you have spheres of silicon and oxygen, and the interaction with light is where you get the opalescence that we see. There's other examples. I mean, probably the best one is diamond. Diamonds form usually from kimberlites, and kimberlites are very rare occurrences.
To explain, kimberlites, which are named after the town of Kimberley in South Africa, where they were first discovered, are igneous rocks containing diamonds. These were formed at great depths where high temperatures and pressures prevail, and were brought to the surface via vertical structures called kimberlite pipes.
That's correct.
Often in the final phases of intrusion of igneous rocks, such as a granite body, you get pegmatite veins, which can contain very large crystals. Do they sometimes carry gems?
Definitely. Pegmatites are really interesting. As you said, they form at the final stages of crystallization of a granitic melt. And so they are water rich, and they also tend to concentrate incompatible elements that wait until the last minute to go into crystals. When pegmatites escape from a parental granite and we get pegmatite veins, they cool very quickly. And turns out this is why they have large crystals. It was always thought, and this is what I was taught as an undergraduate, that the crystals are large because they were slow growing. Well, recent research has shown that this is not the case. That they're large because the pegmatite cooled very quickly, and so it was undercooled and very few nucleation sites, and so the crystals were able to grow to quite large sizes. And often in pegmatites we also have vugs or gas bubbles, and those bubbles can contain very gemmy crystals, and they're always good places to look. For example, the Himalaya mine in Southern California, we get beautiful tourmaline crystals growing into vugs in the pegmatite. So they're definitely great targets.
All these special geological circumstances that give rise to gems seem very local on the scale of perhaps a few meters or kilometers. What about large-scale metamorphic belts? For example, the rubies that are found in Myanmar, which is in the Mogok metamorphic belt on the eastern edge of the Indian plate. Are there gems that result from larger scale tectonic interactions?
Definitely. The one you just mentioned is indication or a hint that at one point we had continent to continent collision. That's what we need to get the high pressures and temperatures to form the corundum gemstones, ruby and sapphire. Another example is jadeite, and we now know that jadeite forms in response to subduction of oceanic plates, and that the elements needed to make the jadeite are subducted to depth, and then we have a melt created with the right elements to make the gem material jadeite. So when we find jadeite, we find the sapphire and ruby, those are strong indications that at one point we had tectonic activity, either subduction or continent-to-continent collision, even if there aren't many other signs of those things left. And this has led to them being dubbed plate tectonic gemstones. And there's work ongoing right now on other gemstones to see what they can tell us about prior large-scale geological events.
Wow, that's fascinating. So these can act as tracers when all the other continental or subduction evidence has gone away. The gems are the survivors.
That's correct, yep.
Okay, so let's say if one of the unusual circumstances required to form gemstones arises, are we pretty much guaranteed to find gemstones? To use your first example, if we bring beryllium and chromium together, are nice emerald crystals always going to form?
No, to get a gem, you also need conditions that allow a crystal to grow in a perfect way. And often you'll grow a crystal and then there'll be post-crystallization deformation. And this actually happens with a lot of emerald occurrences, where the crystal is broken up or shattered after it's crystallized by tectonic forces. And so to get a gem, your crystal needs to have been protected somehow. And this can be through being at fold hinges or growing in a pocket with micas or a gas-filled vug in a pegmatite. That crystal has to be protected somehow from deformation. And so a number of things have to come together to give you a gem.
Just to explain, a vug is a smallish cavity inside a rock, most commonly formed within cracks and fissures opened up by folding and faulting. So presumably gems have to be protected from deformation not only while they're growing, but also throughout subsequent geological history till we find them.
That's correct. And there was an important emerald discovery in the Yukon Territory in the late 90s, and everyone hoped it would become a mine. Beautiful looking crystals up to several inches in length. But when you start cutting them, you realize that they've all been shattered. They've all been broken up by post-crystallization deformation. So what initially looked like a very promising deposit didn't turn out at all. Lots of material, beautiful color, but the largest stones ever cut from that deposit are about 2.5 carats, and the market looks for a consistent supply of larger stones.
So was it near some large faults, or what made it so deformed?
The emeralds crystallized about 100 million years ago, but they're only 15 kilometers from a huge fault called the Tintina Fault that cuts right across the Yukon Territory. And that was active up until about 75 million years ago. Yeah, I mean, there was obviously local deformation associated with that fault, and that's why the emeralds are shattered, broken up.
Do you think that given how rare each of these gem-forming geological settings appears to be, that we've already found most of the sites in the world that are conducive to growing emeralds?
Oh, good heavens, no. Much of the world, I think, is underexplored with respect to especially the colored gemstones. And if we look at countries like Canada and Russia, they're huge areas with a lot of forest cover, glacial till, etc. Yeah, that they're very underexplored. Also, people doing exploration, usually looking for metals, not looking for gemstones. And they probably aren't looking, but really wouldn't know where to look. And so one thing we're doing is creating exploration guidelines for the colored gemstones. And an area I've mentioned before that I think has great promise is northwestern Canada, where we have a handful of emerald occurrences and where we think that there is great potential for more.
When we were talking earlier, you said that it's no accident that most of the places where we've already found gemstones happen to be in very populated areas, because that's where people are and they're looking for all kinds of stuff. So if you go out, as you obviously have, into the middle of nowhere, you're saying we could be finding just tons more.
We could be. The question is how to explore. And yes, we have very low population density, so people are not finding these things by accident. And we often use stream sediment surveys to explore for metals. And we're looking at how we could identify the minerals in a stream sediment sample to help us explore for gems. And another thing is using drones. My students have been using drones to successfully explore for peridot, which is gem olivine, in British Columbia. And they say that what used to take 3 weeks, they can do in 2 days with a drone. So things like this might help us evaluate large areas relatively rapidly.
But you still apply some kind of a geological filter up front where you're looking for these circumstances that you just described to me.
Definitely. In northwestern Canada, we have large expanses of black shales that look very similar to what we see in Colombia. And the discovery in 2010 of the Colombian-type emerald in the Northwest Territories is a real hint that the conditions are right, that we should go looking for more.
Do you think there are any hidden subduction zones or continental collisions lurking up there in the Northwest Territories or the Yukon?
Well, I don't know. Geologically, it's a real mess. There's lots of terrains. And this is an active subduction zone today, so who knows what's possible. There's a lot of fragments of ruby and sapphire that have been found in Western Canada. And so one of my former students is following up on that.
For my last question, I want to ask you about the most impressive gemstone you've ever seen in the field and what you know about how it formed.
I really had to think about this one because I've seen some very impressive things in the field. But I think the most impressive was cobalt blue spinel on Baffin Island. It's a bright royal blue color, and it's in the middle of nowhere, and you can see it meters away, these blue crystals in a white marble outcrop. And as far as I know, they're still up there, but that was really, really impressive. We did a lot of research to find out how they formed, and our conclusions were that the cobalt, the chromophore, must have been in the original sediments that have gone through a very tortuous metamorphic history to give us the spinel. We were up there primarily to study a sapphire deposit, which is very close to the cobalt blue spinel. In fact, it's about a half-hour walk. And the sapphires were discovered in 2002 by some local brothers who were out hunting and stopped for a break and saw these blue stones in the rock. And they're beautiful blue sapphires, and I went up there soon after that, and it took about 15 years to sort out how they formed. And again, it's a very tortuous metamorphic history. But we did do that, and we finally got together our paper, and we were going to publish it in the summer of 2017. And I was home that summer for a week or two, and I turned on the national news, and there was Canada's Governor General presenting a brooch to the Queen Elizabeth on the occasion of her sapphire jubilee. And the brooch was made of Canadian diamonds and these sapphires. And the Governor General actually even called them beluga sapphires, which is what we had been calling them. It's just total coincidence that our paper was going to be published later on the same week. There was quite a bit of media attention to the fact that the same week this brooch was being presented to the Queen, that the scientific study showing how the sapphires had formed was being published.
Lee Grote, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more about Geology Bites, as well as pictures and diagrams that illustrate this podcast, you can go to geologybites.com.